You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.
Today on our show, we're talking with Mary Mattingly. She's an artist that's living and working in New York. Mary, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
So let's talk about your current work. I know a lot of your projects and your past work, which I'd like to get to, but what is it that you're focused on now that you're building or in the planning stages of?
There are about three projects that are being planned right now. One is, that's the one that's closest, is in Havana with the National Museum of Fine Arts, and that's called Pull. And it's basically two sculptures that are pulled across Havana, and one is set up inside the museum and one in the Parque de Central, and they are kind of spherical ecosystems. So they have things living inside of the walls, and then you can walk into the spheres, and sometimes there will be performances by other people going on inside, and other times you might just have it yourself.
Okay, wait a minute. So you have to explain that more. That sounds great. So these are spheres that are large enough to kind of house a type of exhibit, and you can enter into the spheres, and the spheres are being pulled across a landscape across Savannah. Is that correct?
Yeah. So they're pulled together from materials from New York and Havana. And I realized maybe I should have known this, but it's really hard to get anything that you're actually looking for in Havana. So I had come there with a plan to build something with these long ready rods or something like that, and then ended up finding aluminum drywall studs, and so use that to construct the outer layer of the spheres, and then those will be basically pulled by me, by some people I'm working with, artists and organizers and some volunteers and students, and we'll set them up and then use them for events during the biennial. So it starts out as a performance, but then it becomes more of a stage.
And it's part of the Havana Biennial? Is that what this is part of?
Yeah, it's with the National Museum and also the Bronx Museum, and they're doing a project together where they're switching their collections. So the Bronx Museum will take Havana's collection, I think, next year, and this year Havana will have the Bronx Museum's collection. So it's part of that larger project.
Wow, that sounds really cool. I mean, it's kind of like this, like, I imagine it to be sort of like a caravan almost. There's all these people around it, and it's, I don't know that, I know you've pushed and pulled, you know, things before, but this one seems huge. Is it the biggest thing you've ever done like that, or?
I think by far. I mean, I tried to carry the flock houses. That was something that I did in New York a few years ago with a big group of people, and I wanted to make it so I could carry each section if I took it apart, but it was always done by truck. But this will be really, we'll really be pulling it.
And how far are you pulling it in total?
Good question. Not that far. Probably not even a mile. So it's going from where we're building it in Havana to these two places, which aren't actually that far from each other. So it's definitely, you know, because it's big, it will take a while, but I don't expect it'll take more than an hour to pull it to where it needs to go, and then setting up will be some more time.
And can you explain
what'll happen?
Yeah, it sounds really exciting and ambitious and sort of crazy and wonderful. What will happen when it stops and you set up and people approach it? What will they see, and what will be the experience of entering into it or interacting with it?
It'll be a mini ecosystem in the walls. So we'll be collecting rainwater at the top, and then that's funneling through all these strange plastic containers and tubes and going into some fish tanks. And apparently we're having some insects involved, like butterflies and some other things that we're trying to get permission for that we don't have permission for yet, like bees. which I guess is illegal in Havana. But all the things would be really important to, like, keeping this thing running well. So one of the my side goals is to really have some insects there. But besides that, it's just, like, it's energy, it's water, and it's some food and medicinal plants, basically. And by food, I guess I mean, besides the plants that you can eat, potentially the fish.
So tell me about what it means to be running well. The fish, meaning their fish tanks, and it's keeping all of that operational. Like, what does it mean? I know you've create these systems, and perhaps we should go back and talk about just the genesis of these kind of ecosystems that you create. But to be clear, in this project, what is being sustained within that sphere? And if, let's say, there are insects in there, how are they sustained, contained, and how do they contribute to the
structure? For instance, there would be pollinators, so hopefully there will be bees and there'll be other pollinators and the butterflies, for instance, but we would also probably have something like crickets, something else that can help the garden, ladybugs or things that do that. So as many different sort of insect farms as we can have where they have their own sort of habitat to go back to, but then they can spread through these walls. These walls are basically screened, so you can, the things really have some areas where they can, they'll have some areas where they can escape if they want to, but they're pretty much inside of the walls. So I don't know what it will look like at the end. I feel like they will have taken over the structure. So what it looks like in the beginning will be pretty different in the end. And I'm not sure when the end is exactly.
But so wouldn't that be kind of, I mean, that sounds scary to me, entering a structure filled with insects. Maybe I'm just kind of insect like a person, but I mean, I understand why they need to be in there, but wouldn't they
yeah.
kind of interact
well, the
with
walls,
you or?
So there's two sets. So there's, imagine you're building a wall with two layers. So it's kind of like that. The walls are really thick. They're about, in some places they're almost 2 feet thick. So they're screened in between the two layers of the wall. So they're not actually in the space that you're in, but they have their own space. So
okay.
It's pretty much like a sphere inside of a sphere makes up a sculpture.
Okay.
And then
That's super exciting. That sounds great. And go on. And then what?
Yeah, and then they have that space inside the two spheres. And then you have the space in the center. I'm realizing how hard it is to articulate this idea.
That's okay. It's nice to visualize it. I'm getting a visualization of the whole thing, and it's radio, it's audio, so it's kind of nice for people to picture this. And on the post of this, there is also images of your work. So you said there was three projects you were working on. That's one. Are there two others?
There's a project I'm working on right now in Des Moines. That's a wading bridge. That's pretty complicated permit-wise, but definitely a lot, probably easier to explain. It's just a bridge that's about 3 inches under the water in the Raccoon River in Des Moines. So that's also something that the timeline isn't quite as near, but it's the beginning of June. And then besides that, the thing that I've been focusing on here in New York is called Swale, and I'm very excited about it. It's a floating food forest, and to me it really pushes the boundaries of, I guess, making food, public food in public space. So if the water can be considered public space in New York, then it's trying to push those permit boundaries and see what we could actually make that could be legal to be public.
So ideally, how would it function and how would the public interact with that?
Ideally, it would find a more permanent home. Right now, it has a lot of temporary homes, potentially. But it would find probably a dock somewhere in the five boroughs and would be a structure that you would walk onto whenever you wanted to and pick food. So it's really... I don't know, it's merging art and I guess the food forest movement, which I think is starting. I mean, there's one.
I don't know about the food forest movement. What is that? And what are people, like, what food is in the forest? You know, like, let's say it's all set up and it's going. I mean, maybe that's two questions, but what is the food forest movement and what food would be in your, I guess, mini forest?
Well, if we are thinking about urban agriculture in a way where we're having to replant every season, this would just be eliminating that. So it's just basically perennials. You're looking at, like, what trees provide food, what other perennials provide food, and how do they symbiotically help each other grow in a smaller space.
So an example of what I would eat would be what?
You might eat something like blueberries and nuts.
Blueberries and nuts. Yeah, that sounds great. Right, that sounds really ambitious. So you have a nut tree there, an almond tree that's
you could have fruit trees, you could have nut trees, I think that's maybe the part that I'm excited about is that it in this type of project it would really be formed by the process of like figuring out what is legal right now and what we can get away with on the water that we can't on land in New York City potentially. And also what happens through the process of collaboration and compromising. So I have a vision in my mind that it's a torus shape. So it actually looks like sort of a dome with an inverted center, and then inside the torus you actually can just walk around in a circle and forage. It's kind of a dream, but I think it's happening.
I love the dream. I love it. So in the dream then, as it's realized, there's obviously a limited amount there. This isn't a large forest. It's kind of this mini system.
Right.
What stops it from being kind of depleted from, you know, a small crowd kind of foraging it clean?
That's interesting that you say that, because that's actually the Parks Department's rationale for not doing it, is that, you know, we could have parks like this in all over New York City, but what would happen if everyone all of a sudden decided that they wanted to or needed to forage for food, then it would be gone. Yeah, I guess it's true. I mean, I think that for the art project, it's more of a proposal. So if it can be completed and it does well and no one gets hurt, say, no one sues me for getting sick off of some fruit, then potentially it's a precedent. So I think maybe it's not really anything more than that.
Well, and perhaps, you know, there's certainly plenty of art exhibits where you can take things for free, things are given away, and it seems to me there's a kind of a natural balance. People tend not to go in and just kind of destroy the scene or take everything that we're perhaps aware when coming into a space like that it's not ours to just consume as much as possible, that we have to leave behind something for other people. Do you think that's part of what would
happen? That could happen. I think either or. I think that that's probably the way that most people understand public space in cities. And even if you think something is open and you might be able to get in, a lot of times people don't go in. Just maybe they think that they're being monitored. That's how I feel.
Right.
So, I don't think that's everyone, but...
No, I think,
but
I think
do,
that's...
I, right. Oh, I was just going to say, probably we have to have it, have someone there whenever, just for safety reasons, I would imagine. So that's kind of one of the hurdles when I'm trying to see how we can do that.
Yeah, it's interesting in projects where the public is allowed to interact, I guess where the limits are, something almost gets set free. I mean, I haven't heard too many scenarios where, and of course I'm involved in this kind of work myself, and mm-hmm. rarely is, you know, do people take advantage, but it happens. You know, just in giving out hugs or whatever, people can get groped or I remember that something that was kind of funny was that Gavin Brown, I don't know if you remember this, a few years ago, there was a Rick Ritchie Venezia show in that garage-like space, and Gavin Brown's car was parked in there, and the keys were in it, and artists thought that was part of it, and they took his car for a drive.
Yeah.
That was sort of outrageous, you know? There was kind of all this talk about it, but they also felt like they weren't being malicious. Just the atmosphere lent itself to feeling like, is anything possible? But to me, that's also what's exciting about it, isn't it? It's, you know, we're also relying on kind of how human we are, how generous we'll be with each other, because you're being generous and giving.
Yeah, it's kind of like you are testing your ideas for utopia or your vision for how you could imagine the world. And if you don't do it, then maybe nobody else will. So more people who are probably testing trust boundaries with strangers, I could only imagine the more it will be usual, and people won't take Evan Brown's car for a spin without asking him.
So those are three really exciting projects. What I want to ask is, how do you interact with the marketplace? All of these seem completely out of the marketplace. They seem like they require a lot of funding. If you can go into mm-hmm. that, how is all your work funded, and is it also in the marketplace? Do you sell works?
Yeah, so I've been working with Robert Mann Gallery since 2006 and selling photographs, and I guess I usually make three types of photographs, or maybe two. I guess the photograph that I've been selling at Robert Mann is usually based on a proposal. It's some sort of proposal for what a future could look like or what a future project could be. And then the photographs that I never really sell are the documents, which I would love to, but I sometimes give them away, and those are just the documents of the projects. But the public projects usually work in a couple of different ways for me. Sometimes if I don't, I usually feel like grants take too long to apply for, and the work that we're doing probably feels more urgent than that, so I never have the patience to sit down and start grant writing, which I wish I did. But I'll try other ways, so I'll try to barter for things. Like, for instance, I have this sculpture that's been in this exhibition in Omaha that I thought, if it doesn't sell, I'll try to trade it for all the plants that I need for this project coming up that I was just describing. Well, so I don't know. There are ways that I try to work like that, where I'm either reusing things or trading, or trying to figure out a fair way to do something. For instance, whether it's working with an in-kind donor for something else. I don't know. Every project is so different. So the last thing that I did in Philadelphia is called Wetland, and it looks like a sinking house on a boat, and that actually just out of the blue got a grant, and that was something that an organization applied for on my behalf, and I didn't even really know about until I heard the good news. So that has never happened before. But I usually rely on the first model of trying to figure out how you can sort of mutually make a positive situation for everyone involved by doing a project where you can show off someone's goods, for instance, on a project, and they get something from it, and then you get the goods.
And that doesn't include, though, all the I imagine, volunteers and all the work you're putting into this. There's still a tremendous amount of your own resources that are going into it. The in-kind donations help sustain some of these projects, and they seem to be, you know, needing of that kind of sustenance. But there's there's so much else that's going into it. Isn't there also funding that you have to personally put into it of your own, or can you avoid that?
I mean, it definitely depends on what project, but I have for most all of them. I mean, even if I'll get a commission to do something, I never end up walking away with money from it, it seems. I think that the way that I'm trying to work now is a little bit different, where the wetland boat is something that I use that grant money to buy outright. So now the sculpture is still in Philadelphia and it's still being used. And it's sort of sustaining itself. I think I'll need to find some way to monetarily, say, pay for dockage if it's too cold to let it stay on the water over winter or something like that. But I think that there's a way for some of these things to work pretty non-monetarily if the setup is there in the beginning. And I think the beginning setup is what you usually need the funding for. So, yeah, I'm selling work sometimes. For the water pod, me and four friends sold portfolios of our work so we could get insurance at the last minute.
And are you also teaching or doing other jobs?
Yeah, I'm teaching at Cooper Union right now, and I have been lecturing a lot. So between those things and then selling every now and then, I'm pretty much like skirting by.
Well, in a way that seems almost like to complete the system, right? You're creating these ecosystems. You're creating, you know, this way, all these new kind of ideas of how we can impact the earth in different ways or less or be self-sustaining. It would make sense that financially that should somehow, I mean, the trading seems to apply there as well, that somehow the financial sustenance of your projects are almost a part of what you're doing, or am I reaching there?
No, definitely, definitely. I mean, I think that a lot of the things have, like, especially WaterPod was really an experiment to see whether if we could create all the things that we needed and that we were purchasing on a daily basis, then what would be the time difference? Do we spend more time working our day jobs at that time or keeping up these living systems? So I think finding a balance there gave me hope that it was possible, I think, just because we started out with these living systems that took us all day to upkeep, like a lot longer than we spent working. But by the end of the project, it was pretty much seamless. It was just running itself. So it made me think that if you had the ability to put everything together in the beginning, or if we were able to each have a little bit of what our neighbors needed, if we were each, say, growing more food than we needed, and could supplement each other, then we could actually sort of seamlessly potentially build the city that is less dependent on the material supply chains that we're so used to that really just, you know, take from the rural, move through the city, and then end up in a landfill. Seems to be the biggest problem that I'm struggling with in the work that I've been making recently.
Mary, thanks so much for talking with us today. It's really been a pleasure hearing about your new projects, and I wish you the very best with them.
Thanks.
You're listening to Yale Radio WIBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.